You're listening to UnConcast on the Georgia Podcast Network, featuring unconference sessions and other related discussions from around the Southeast.
We're going to talk about how to be a winning technology entrepreneur. So, hi, come on in. So, so does anybody want to? Does anybody have any questions, comments? Besides the reporter, anybody have anybody want to talk about anything? Are you recording this too? You're not recording this.
Yeah,
right?
I am.
Okay.
You're gonna be famous now.
Yes.
No, I'm not famous. Not that kind. I don't want to be that kind of famous. Hi, come on in. So does anybody have any comments to kick it off? Andrew looks like he wants to talk. He's got something burning in his mind. You can see he's thinking about it. But what does it take?
I hear a lot, unfortunately, I go to a lot of these
how to do things,
and I hear a lot of the, you can't really do it until you jump in both feet, burn your boats, mortgage your house, you know, risk losing your wife. But I haven't been able to realize that level of desperation yet. I'm still trying to build it on the side, keep the bread and gravy stuff going.
So tell us, just for the context for everybody, like, what do you mean? I know it's a secret idea, you can't tell anybody, but just go ahead.
what's
your dream? What's your passion?
My passion is to give people the tools to help them manage their attention. It seems like a very nebulous thing right now, but that's the big idea. To bring it down to something more concrete is a personal pain I have, which is I hate keeping track of my time and generating invoices. Because I'm an independent consultant. I've got like four or five clients going at any time. Some of them are primary, and I'm doing a lot of work for. I might even spend a whole day working on one client's stuff. But most days, you know, I'm working for a half an hour on this guy. I pick up the phone, it's the other guy. I got to stop. And then, you know, I hang up the phone. It's like, oh, crap, was that 15 minutes or 45 minutes?
Yeah, so you have a problem because you don't get paid if you don't bill.
I don't get paid if I don't bill, and I try to be very responsible in my billing, so I try to be granular and prove people. It's like, you know, I'm not just going to, like, turn the clock on and, like, go to lunch with my friends.
Like all of our lawyers do.
Right.
So, any lawyers in here? Okay.
My wife is a lawyer.
Okay. Then you know the feeling.
That's why he gets to be here.
Exactly. That's why you get to be fun thing, right?
Right, so... to bring it, a lot of things I hear is try to bring it down to a niche, a focused effort that you can implement now. Use that to help understand where you're going with your big vision so that you can gain traction in a small hoop, you know, a small pond. Don't try to boil the ocean with your great idea. Start with something that's discrete. So my first discrete step towards this is to create a system where you can easily track your time on your iPhone because you always have it with you. Not always the case, you're not always in front of your computer. And make it basically a service that allows you to quickly and easily just suck it into QuickBooks and generate your invoices. That's the first step that a lot of people can understand. Oh, I understand what that is. Also, I've got in beta process, Bluetooth proximity, GPS location, watching the activity within application on the computer, all funneling into my back-end system. So basically, I'm building a system that can watch what I'm doing, and the system can understand when I'm working on client X versus client Y. That's kind of stage two, and then the next step beyond that would be, now that I've collected that, making an intelligent system that then holds the world back and says, you know, I'm working on client A. And if client B calls, he goes to voicemail. But if client A calls, he rings. You know, maybe client B sees my IM feed is active, but B sees it as I'm out to lunch. You know, that would be a simple way. But, you know, we all work a lot, and, you know, it starts encroaching into our personal time, and, you know, we don't get enough exercise. It's like, you know, sometimes you need somebody to say, hey, buddy, quit watching YouTube, get to some billable work, and stop working and go spend some time.
Yeah, we need more technology to help us manage the technology we have.
Yeah, exactly. So that's my idea. People want to
sit here and tell you how you're going to solve that problem.
Nah,
He's done that. He's jumped all the way head first.
No, I was curious, Jeff. You've done some companies here in Atlanta. Now you're out in Silicon Valley, you know, in the big lights, all that. Winning, the term winning, right? What does that actually mean? Because, you know, in my mind, it's not, everything doesn't have to be Appcelerator, right? It doesn't have to be that level. You know, talk to me about, like, what you've seen and what you guys have all seen. What is winning? What is losing?
I think it's defined by what you want. I mean, it's, you know, to your own sort of definition. I mean, for me, winning is, you know, building a big software company and, you know, impacting the world with a set of software. To plenty of people, winning might just be being able to have the freedom to work when they want and to be able to make good, you know, disposable income and be able to go on vacations if they want and not have to worry about investors. You know? Certainly, those challenges that I live with are much different than the smaller business owner that can sort of control their lives and sort of can make good money and, you know, kind of control their own destiny. So it's a balance, right? You have to give up. I have to give up a little bit to achieve my dream. And, you know, what are you guys giving up to achieve yours? Whether it's quitting your job and going full time and mortgaging your house, like probably some people have done, a lot of people probably miss now, or whatever. But I mean, the definition is relative. I mean, success is relative. I mean, certainly it's much more relative in the Valley because, you know, you're talking about people like Steve Jobs and Sergey Brin and people that are like really super successful. To people like me who aren't that successful. So, you know, it's a different sort of relativeness when it comes to success. And then here, it's very different too. Like, you can be a top lawyer or a real estate mogul or, you know, a reasonably successful software person and be considered a very successful person here, whereas in the Valley, people might look at that like, okay, that's, you're small, you're tiny. But it doesn't matter, really. It matters to what I think your own personal goals and dreams are. And how do you, what are the tools and what are the things that you can do to actually achieve them? I think that, you know, what does everybody else think about success? How would you guys define success?
For me, I think success will be defined in having creativity to create the software the way I would do it ideally if I didn't have any constraints. And when I was in the professional world, everybody said, you're going to use technology X, Y, or Z. And whether I had a great opinion of it or a poor opinion of it or an extremely poor opinion of it, I had to use it. And for me, it's more about being able to create software that people would want to use the way I would want to create it.
Yeah, that's I think that's very, I mean, that's awesome. Hold on, we'll come back to you because she's been putting her hand up.
Mm-hmm.
Yes?
Well, actually, I had a different question. Do you want me to define success?
Yes, please. We're all wanting to know.
Well, I think that, like you said, it's different for every person. It's you create your own goal, and achieving that goal is you feel successful, then you are successful.
Yeah. You want to go
ahead? Yeah. I think, realistically, though, success is a cumulative kind of thing. It's not a single goal, because you don't know where your goal is going to be when you're starting a website startup, for example. You know, success for me is every little nice tweet I see, it makes me happy. And then that's the success. And that's what keeps me going on and not sleeping very much and keeping on going. Those have a cumulative effect in which then you start to see where you want to go. You don't know what you want when you first start one of these things. You say, I want to have a big website, and I want it to do this, this, that, and the other. I want to get on TechCrunch. I want to be in Mashable. Yay. What happens when you get that, like the first day you launch? Oh, shit. Where to next? Now I want to make a big business. Well, you have to take these things cumulatively, or else they're just going to, you know, you're just going to be kind of chasing your tail.
Yeah. So,
I guess for a different point of view, you know, success for me is like imposing own deadlines or the deadlines that my co-conspirators agree upon, and, you know, executing upon those, reaching them with a level that we feel like is excellence, given the situation, and, you know, having some, like, a tangible result that comes from that. So I think that it's a series, yeah, you know, it's ongoing, but it's a series of those kind of checkpoints, and, you know, it's not something amorphous, you know?
Yeah, I definitely agree with that. I mean, do you guys feel like you have the tools and means to be successful? Anybody feel like they don't? They need something that they don't have?
No, yeah, everybody's
successful.
Success, like experience, right? Failure. I mean,
failure, you need more failure.
I think there's a lot of people that get into this game, right, that think like the reality of them making Facebook in Atlanta get blocked out here, right? But, you know, I don't know. If I ask the same question in Silicon Valley, how many people do you think would say things like, sex is what you make of it?
I think
98%
people would say that. 80%? 98%. 98%. So would anybody say different here? I mean, I don't think there's any difference there. Does anybody think that success isn't what you make of it? It's because, you know, the stimulus package is going to give us success. I mean, is there something that sort of is external to your own the capability that's holding you back?
I think communities have a notion of success. They go, like, if my goal is to run a company completely out of business, like, I think a lot of people wouldn't be like, he's a winning entrepreneur. Maybe that doesn't matter, right? But at some level, doesn't the community impose some sort of standard upon it?
You know, I think that's if you let it. I mean, I think that's what happens often in smaller communities. I think you become fairly myopic about how you define things. But, I mean, what's to say that, you know, what's that success? You control your own success. And
so it's all just relative.
I'm using that term, but yeah, let me see. We've got the bingo card. What can I use? Your influence matters.
Oh, yeah, that's very interesting.
I mean, but you kind of, one of the reasons drove you to Silicon Valley was access to relationships.
Yeah, maybe. To me, it's people. People matter. I mean, it's not that people in Atlanta are important, it's just the types of people I was dealing with on a daily basis is the people that are relevant for me are people that were there. And so it's like, well, I'm tired of like IMing people and emailing people and saying, well, gosh, next time I'm out in 3 months, we'll maybe get together. And when you're out, you only have you're trying to get home and then you don't have time. So to me, it was about, you know, which I think is a lot of why you're probably here. It's about connecting with people that sort of understand what you're doing, whether they believe in it or not, but they sort of have an understanding of it. And frankly, I got tired of, you know, sitting in a cafe in downtown Atlanta and somebody says, what do you do? And I say, I'm a software entrepreneur. And they go, what does that mean? In the Valley, they say, what startup do you work at? Yeah. I mean, because they just assume you work for Google. Like, oh, you're not with a startup. You're not cool. You're a big company. Yeah. Go ahead, Sue.
So there's very little chance that this city of Atlanta will get picked up and like brought over physically to
probably California. Not. I mean, it might. So the global warming, you know.
That's actually a big idea.
So considering those chances being slim, I mean, you know, do you have any recommendations of ways that we could kind of keep in sync, not only with, you know, West Coast, but also other vital areas of the world that, you know, we don't really have a lot of good ongoing relationships with, you know, in a political sense?
I mean, I think it's what we're doing. I mean, it's why we're here. I think it's the types of, you know, communities that we're trying to build. I think Atlanta's, I think it's a fallacy to think that Atlanta can or should be like the Valley, no different than, Idaho is not going to be, you know, the potatoes, and they're not going to try to be like the, New York stockbroker capital. So you got to figure out what you're good at. I'm not a big, I do believe Atlanta has sort of this brand problem, but I'm not sort of like the Atlanta.net, what's creative website. I don't think that's the way of going about doing it, but I think the brand is the people in the room, it's the community, it's what people sort of do and the successes we have together, it's that shared sort of social contract. I think, I think success begets success, and that's what you see. And then, when you see big companies, and we've seen it here, I mean, Turner, spun out a lot of successful people out of Turner, and Ted Turner, what he did. It's a shame that we weren't able to sort of capitalize on that and make Atlanta more of a media town. The CDC is here in town. I've always been talking about this a lot. You know, Emory is a top medical school in the world. You know, world renowned. People flying from all over the world to come to Emory. But we have no really sizable media biomed startups, and certainly not any big investments in research. We did for a while and some smaller kind of things, but we've had some decent success in security, and certainly there's a nice cluster there. But again, that's always been like, well, I don't really want to, so whatever. We don't want to do another security startup. Well, why not? So,
well, I wanted to get back a little bit on the entrepreneur side here, and definitely social media. What I sense out there is when you go out and you're an entrepreneur in the social media area, it's a difficult sell to corporations.
Is social media, you're saying?
Social network solutions. So
are difficult to bigger companies or corporate enterprises?
The ROI value propositions seem to be difficult. So I wonder if anybody has any experience in positioning this.
Like, anybody have any? I have opinions, but I don't want to dominate them. But anybody else have opinions on that?
I could say two, but I'll let
you. Yeah. There we go. No, he can't talk. He works at a big company, so.
Okay.
Go ahead.
Well, I think there's pockets in the big companies that do get it, and I think they're starting to maybe formalize that. That's just from talking to different people who work in the big companies.
Yeah, my sense is that I think there's this onslaught happening, and it's sort of like a lot of technology trends. The people in the power don't sort of see it, and they're going to be kind of pushed out of power anyway. And I just sort of think that it's like any inevitable. I mean, this happened with email, for God's sake. It happened with IM and the enterprise. I remember back in the day, it happened with fax. I remember companies that would refuse to do faxing. It was a big thing, you know. They used to, you know, in the typewriter pool days. You know? So it's going to happen. It's just an inevitable trend. You can't stop. I mean, I've seen more and more corporate people on Facebook and on LinkedIn than I've ever seen in the last year. So I think it's going to happen.
I've said for years and years that if you look at the social networks of the day, and back when I started saying it was Usenet was the social network
exactly.
of the day. Look at what the regular participants are saying is going to destroy the media. And that's the next big thing. Really. And what you hear today is social media consultants are killing us. They're going to ruin this whole thing for us. So that's kind of the harbinger to me that corporate world is starting to get it. The bigger companies that are worried about their risk management are starting to get it because there are these consultants that are destroying the medium for us. They're actually out there bringing the big boys into the playing field.
What do you see? You work at a big, sort of semi-big media outlet, you know, traditional media outlet. I mean, what's going on inside that you can talk about? I know you guys have little hoods you have to wear when you do your meetings and stuff.
That's not true. I think, and I don't
your handshake.
Think
they have the journalism handshake.
I'm not Sig Mosley. But
that's true.
The Atlanta Business Chronicle, I think, is starting to get social media. It's hard work. A lot of the thing is the old journalists, old media, and agree we're old media, sort of are, you know, think twice about new medium like Twitter or LinkedIn. I mean, many of them are, they're all on LinkedIn, but nobody knows about Twitter. I'm like the little kid that they humor and say, yeah, go ahead and Twitter your stuff. But I make an effort to go to my editors and explain to them, look, we got this front page story because of Twitter. Someone on Twitter told me that this deal was getting done or that they have a promising startup. Same thing with blogs. We have a blog called Atlantic. It's relatively new. One of the big issues with the Chronicle was because of the competition for real estate, for page space, I could only write about large deals, $5 million and above. But the more people I spoke with said there's a lot of stuff happening in the startup community, and if you don't cover it, you're not going to be able to understand the entire technique. Which is why we launched the blog, which is primarily focused on startups. Yes, we write about smaller deals, but it's primarily profiling companies. We profiled Chris's company, profiled a few other companies.
But I think what's happening is, and I think you're a good representation of this, I think there's a set of people that are coming into these environments and bringing change. I think change is probably happening from within because people from, like, you're, I mean...
You need an advocate in these organizations, otherwise it's not going to happen.
It's been pretty irrelevant in the tech, especially small business tech community. I mean, you know, and we all know it's been driven by advertisers. I mean, that's who pays their bills. So who are they putting on the front covers? It's
right.
The big real estate deals because that's who pays the advertising rates. But if you wouldn't have went there and you wouldn't be doing the things that you're doing and come to the events you came, we've invited the media for 3 years to come to SoCon. They've snuffed us every year and say it's not relevant, doesn't really matter.
I think it's up to the individual.
It's up to the individual.
Nobody forces me to come to these events. I come because I want to grow myself as a reporter and I want the Chronicle to perhaps represent the technology community a little better than they have in the past.
But that's the funny dichotomy, not to diverge a little too much into journalism, but I think it's relevant. That's because I think it's relevant even within big companies with social media. That's the dichotomy because you represent the ABC brand by being
right.
here, and I think you actually make them look more relevant and better by your own personal involvement. What?
I was going to say, that goes two ways, man, because like that article he's talking about, that's the article people want to talk about. Like the GRA, Judicial Register Association, they've seen the other press releases by like different websites. In ABC, they're like, oh my goodness, one of our companies in the ABC, this is huge.
Yeah.
They don't even get that, you know, we're quote just on the blog, which I think is what you say. Like, they think it's all the same thing. Like, they, you know, the consumer of the media that's not, like, in, you know, tapped into the whole, like...
And you're saying because they're not in, you aren't in print, you're on the blog.
They have no idea we're not in print. All they know is someone sent them an article from an ABC reporter and the Atlanta Business Chronicle did an article on Cervini.
And I think that same's true with big companies, and that's the challenge that any big companies have. I mean, you know, typical big companies and even small companies, it's a one, it's always been a one-way conversation that they controlled. I think that's, you know, media has always been that way. We can control the message, we can control the release, we can control it through an embargo, we can control it through sort of how we position what we want. And what's happening with social media and largely the internet in general is that it's now becoming two-way, whether you like it or not. People are talking about your brand, people are talking about your company, people are talking about your individuals that are standing in front of your audiences, whether you like it or not. And now they have a voice, they're being heard.
I think social media has made everyone a publisher and everyone a reporter. Anybody can say whatever they want. And I think ultimately there will be a filtering system. People will get savvy and figure out that this is nothing but a PR pitch. But at the same time, someone who has something relevant and sensible to say will have a platform, and I think that's good.
Yeah, I mean, I think we're already seeing that success in a big, big way.
I think one thing that's important is the word you keep using is you keep using the word conversation. And that's something that's very different, especially when you consider like how you post these articles on a blog. Is, yes, it might initiate, if it was just a article in the print piece, it might be considered a PR piece. Now, though, there's that ability to interact with it and debunk whether it's print or actually contribute more relevant information, whether to say it's this is valid or there's something wrong here. I mean, look at all the stuff that happened around when you guys moved to Silicon Valley. I mean, I'll tell you later offline. I'm just going to comment about that.
Yeah, there's a lot of offline nasty comments about me.
Yeah. Well, yeah, exactly. But you were also defended greatly. Yes. By it. I mean, there was a lot of attack, but it was back and forth. It became a conversation.
Yes.
I mean, I've even heard it mentioned three or four times. I even mentioned it yesterday. 10-year-old book, Clue Train Manifesto. That's what it's all about. Yeah. It's about engaging with people and talking with them. It's no longer I'm just going to tell you what I think and you're going to accept it and take it.
And that's what the print medium does. But like he said, the blog encourages comment. I encourage comment. And I mean, my most recent piece was on band metrics. And there's a pretty negative comment there. I haven't taken it off. There's really no reason for me to take it off. Yeah, absolutely.
You shouldn't. I think. Yeah. I mean, I don't ever take anything.
And I mean, if it was in print, would the guy have sent me a letter? I doubt it. You know, it's too much trouble.
Yeah.
But this way, we can.
And in fact, I think it's a great opportunity. We will oftentimes, obviously, if somebody says something negative about our product, or even if they're not being negative, they're just sort of just making a snide remark. We always engage them in a very positive way to say, hey, how can we? You know, we're here to help and make it better, and you can make it better too. I mean, we have the benefit. We're an open source company, so it's like shut the fuck up, come, you know, help us fix it out. You know, sorry to use that language, but
worded, Jeff.
I'm sorry. sorry, high school. But you know, it's you know, I think that's a great opportunity to turn it. And oftentimes, not every time, but oftentimes, we'll actually get a message back that says, "Wow, they really care." Like the CEO of the company, or the you know, one of the developers of the product actually gave me their opinion, or told us why it works this way, or told us they're going to fix it. You know, it's legitimately a problem, and they're going to fix it in the next release. I mean, 9 times out of 10, that's the reaction, which is the reaction that makes people more, you know, interested in what you're doing and sort of disarms them a little bit. So.
Yeah, I was just going to differentiate. You know, we were talking about, it seemed like we were talking about both internally at a larger organization and then also, you know, the general context of social media. So internally, you know, the big players, of course, SharePoint, you know, Moz 3.0, and, you know, so I think it sucks. I hate it. But, you know, there's a lot of people that are starting to do cool things that add on and you know, morph it into something that actually works. So, you know, I think that there's an in there. And, you know, latching on to that Microsoft brand that, you know, these suits
makes it more
feel comfortable with, you know. I mean, hey, if you can leverage that to get the thing in there, you know, and get that business done. You know?
How does your group kind of unique inside of Turner? How does Turner, like, sort of, internally, how do they use tools like social media or sort of Twitter, like micro, you know, conversational kind of things inside Turner, or do they?
Yeah, we didn't have anything like this until recently. Just recently, like, you know, this past October, November, we launched, and we did a soft launch of this, actually.
was like a kind of LinkedIn slash Facebook type of paradigm tool. And it actually was at the, AOL Time Warner is like the parent company. And that's like the global conglomerate. So it was actually launched at that level.
Oh, wow.
So we won in that way because it's pre-populated with all, everybody's info from all over the world, And then also people could actually put their own images on.
Wow.
As well, which was like a cool, and that's coming along. And then, now it's just some simple functionality, but it's going into group functionality and other things. So that's a start. That's an example of how we're using it. A lot of creators, like animators, just use AIM.
Yeah.
And, use it to death. So
interesting.
Yeah.
Is blogging and Twittering sort of in the corporate context frowned upon? I mean, do you guys have any sort of policies that would say, yeah, you can't do that on corporate time, or you got to watch what you say and or anything like that?
It's
that you can talk of?
It's hard to answer that because there's a lot of different departments and different divisions, I mean, if you're an on-air anchor,
yeah,
it's going to be, like Jeff Podolsky, Huge example there. Do you know about this thing with Jeff? Well, this guy that covered, stories in Africa, right? He had some kind of like an illicit relationship with this woman that, he's not his wife, and this thing came out on her blog about some very like, raw kind of conversation he had back and forth with her, And I mean, of course, he's summarily fired, but I mean, it really depends, who you are and what the thing is about. And, I mean, of course, it's a corporation, there's corporate policies about it. But, I think that, like you said, it's about the internal change and how are people's attitudes about it. What is behind the firewall, if their attitudes are progressing there, then they're going to be much more open and participatory outside.
Is anybody using sort of social media tools to sort of gain business or win over customers or sort of... something that they may be doing today that they couldn't imagine them doing 2 or 3 years ago? Can
sure.
You go to share anything? Because it sounds like a couple of people are nodding their head. Go ahead.
Yeah, I mean, we monitor Twitter and pretty much every social network as much as you can for the name of our website, which is Regata. And we will actively go and address these people. We'll say, if they like it, we'll say, awesome. If they don't like it, we'll see why.
Awesome. Why not?
Yeah. And just like you were saying, we get the best converts from people who are really mad
exactly.
at something. It's because they had JavaScript turned off or they weren't spelling it right or something like that. The typical kind of things. And using that to then kind of get some credibility, being in Atlanta, everyone seems to have a bit of a chip on their shoulder. Oh, we're in Atlanta. It doesn't matter. You use... The product that you have, the social media world out there is a great equalizer. No one knows you're in Atlanta. We make a fairly big deal about it, but you could just be in the Valley and just be some guys down in like Menlo Park. No one knows. They're looking at the value of your product. So if you've got a product that stands up and people come to your site, if it's a website, and say, hey, this is pretty cool, I'm going to use this, it doesn't matter where the hell you are.
Yeah.
The value of what I think Jeff's saying is these relationships that you form in New York and in the Valley are more valuable because they are the people with the loudest megahorn,
yes.
or whatever you call it, megaphone. They speak louder than anyone else here in Atlanta. I mean, sure, we've got our own little community, and Regata's done very, very well here in the community. We have a lot of local support, which we really love. But we've also got a lot of national support, too, with some really great people, and people that I can now call friends. And that's the difference. There you start building relationships that go beyond what can you do for me. It becomes what can I do for you? What can we do together? And let's have a beer. That's what it comes down to.
Just to kind of build on that, I wanted to shift focus with this question though, but as opposed to just answering what it takes to be a winning technology entrepreneur, can we do the dot, dot, dot and say in Atlanta specifically? Because obviously you left for certain reasons, but at the same time, within the last year, and I've been developing a startup now for 18 months, so I can only say from a certain degree. But within the last year, from what I'm seeing, Atlanta is catching up in a hurry.
Yeah.
And I think, we go to Silicon Valley, and then there's an enormous drop off to the next couple, but I think we're in that next batch. I mean, you include Austin, you include Boulder, you include New York even. I think we're right up in there. I say there's no reason why we can't get to like the number two most recognizable place in the entire country.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's, I mean, ultimately it's success that the world, I think, measures in. When Regator gets really well known and everybody in the world knows who Regator is as much as they know who you know, Twitter is, you get three or four of those, and then, and again, this is a web-based business. I'm not trying to sort of say it at all. It's a web-based business. It can be any business. I mean, it just, you need clusterings of things to people to go, oh, wow. Now, how does that help you as an individual, as an individual entrepreneur? I mean, I think it's like events like this. I mean, a lot of stuff I've seen since I've left has been a lot of what we've tried to start, which is, you know, the startup riots, things that sort of Sanjay's doing. I mean, now Startup Lounge, you got heard of that, like what Scott Burkett's doing. I mean, you're talking about the quality of that event, no offense to Tag, but the quality of those two events, I mean, it's like night and day. You got real entrepreneurs versus, you know, suits trying to sell you insurance. I mean, you know, it's like real people, same sort of a stage of, you know, maybe not same type of ideas, but same sort of things, and it's a little more real, right? And now, you know, it's been going on a year or so, and people have to sort of take it for real. Co-working, a lot of the jellies, and that's certainly a concept that's being done a lot of other places. Atlanta's now just starting to do it. So I think there's a lot of events like this that show sort of maturity from the community, but it's happening because the community's doing it. You know, nobody's doing it for us, right? I mean, it's because you decided to come to this today, you might meet some people, and decide you guys are going to get together and co-work next week.
Let me ask just one quick question to follow up. If your company, where it stands right now, we could have fast-forwarded a couple of years from now, and Atlanta continues to progress the way we've been progressing, let's say, over the last year, would there have been a better likelihood that you might have considered sticking around
here? Maybe. I mean, you know, I have to look at it. I'm in a little of a special, I think maybe I'm not, but to my own justification, I'm in a little bit of a special, different situation, because the people that I'm selling to directly, which are key technology influencers, are all in a 30-mile or 20-mile square radius, and that they have the loudest megaphone in the entire world. They drive 98% of the influence that happens in the technology world. As much as social media drives a lot of it, you can do software anywhere in the world. At the end of the day, if you look back the origins, it comes into Silicon Valley. That's where the biggest influences are. So for me and the type of what I'm trying to do from a company standpoint, it made a lot of sense. No different than if I was trying to be a Hollywood actor, I could probably do, you know, maybe make it, you know, if public, you know, American Idol comes through, maybe I could get on TV that way or whatever. But, you know, you're probably going to be a lot closer to all the production facilities and the producers and that world if you lived in Hollywood. You still wouldn't necessarily mean you're going to be a great actor if you're an actress if you moved out there, but it certainly would get you a lot closer to running into somebody on the streets that has a script that you read and you get into the studio and, you know, boom. It's about relationship, right? And so for me, that was my thing. That's, you know, even if Atlanta had the best events in the whole wide world, those people would still be in the valley. And so for me, that was why I moved there. It really had a lot less to do with Atlanta, because we would have raised money regardless. I mean, people will go, money will come to wherever you're at. I mean, the best ideas, money will get there, believe me. This fallacy that there's no money in Atlanta is bupkis, it's nonsense. There's more money on the sidelines in Atlanta than there ever has been. Lots of people are losing money right now, but certainly there's a lot of money in Atlanta. That's why a lot of money's been going into real estate, because there's not, you know, this vacuum from a startup world standpoint. Go ahead, I know there's a lot of people that are dying to talk, so I'm going to try to come back to you guys. So let me get Sailor and I'll come to you, because I know you haven't spoken. I want to hear you.
Yeah, I do want to hear you. You just mentioned Tag, though, and your take on it, which I think is totally accurate. You know, I've got involved in Tag recently, and it's for the express purpose of what you're saying, you know, change from within. And I know that I can execute upon that small piece of change, you know, and make it a different thing. It's a well-established organization, you know.
It's a great organization.
You might as well use that thing to try and...
If you can, yeah, you know, it's great. I mean, the challenge is all oftentimes at bigger organizations like this, mm-hmm. is and it happens at the APC, it happens in all of our lives, is that when you get paid by somebody, when they're writing the check, it taints you, right? I mean, it's lobbyists in Washington. We're going through this right now. I mean, at the end of the day, that's what's happening. And I think Tag's suffering from that. And it's not because they don't have great you know, morals and great ideas about what they want to do for technology. They have the purest technology ideas in Atlanta. I mean, they've always had great ideas about how to... The problem is, you know, who's going to pay those salaries and who's going to actually pay the bills to make all that stuff continue? And it's going to be IBM, Georgia Pacific, Chick-fil-A, all these companies that have a certain agenda, have a certain audience, and need, you know, need to get paid back. And that sometimes shapes you, you know, and that's part of the challenge. When you have events like this, we're not bound by any of that. I mean, certainly have some sponsors and whatever, but I mean, it's just about us getting together, having a conversation. Well, let's just figure, we're not trying to make money here. Let's just figure out how to actually afford this and just get people to actually get in a room and have a conversation. You have a lot more genuine. Same thing when you do co-working, same thing when you do some of these events. You have this opportunity to be a little bit more pure about it. So who pays for those tag events? It's those real estate agents and recruiters and all the salespeople that show up that they pay for that. So, but that's also, it sort of gets to a point where it's tough because none of the real entrepreneurs really want to go because I don't want to get 15 business cards from recruiters to sit there and talk about what I'm doing and how they've got 15 people to come work for me. I want to talk to an entrepreneur, you know, somebody that I can connect with and network with and talk about real stuff. And so that's the balance. So I think it does, but you got to sort of figure out how to shift. And I think change will come because they ultimately they'll die on the vine if they just keep doing it the way they've been doing it. And I think same will happen with the ABC. I mean, you know, I think, you know, there's some real danger there from an old media standpoint. It's a big company. They're probably not going to go away. I mean, AJC's not going to go away. I just think their sphere of influence will change and shift.
Absolutely.
So,
if I can help it.
I'd like to sort of get down to a little bit of the nitty-gritty about starting a venture, because I'd be very curious if you could describe to us how you went about getting your venture capital for the first venture you ever did.
It's always been the same process. It just gets a little bit easier. Why? Because relationships.
Well, you develop a reputation of success.
It just becomes easier, right?
That first time when you don't have a reputation that is always the big challenge. I know in my own case, most of the ventures that I've done over the years, bootstrapped them myself, and the few times that I've had to go out for venture capital has been a nightmare, because then you're bringing in the ideas of other people may clash with your own.
It never gets easier. Actually, it does get easier, but the nightmare is still the same. Yeah. It's still the single most destructive thing you'll ever do in your,
So how do you handle that with, do you try to bootstrap your venture at all costs, or do you try to go out and look for venture capital? And if you do go out to find venture capital, how do you present yourself? How do you prove yourself to these venture capitalists? And how do you find the right day?
Yeah, well, I mean, that's a kind of a broad question. So it's if you're a dry cleaning business or franchise and you've got a bunch of dry cleaners, you're never going to raise venture capital. That's not a venture-funded business.
Yeah, well, we're talking about technology.
Yeah, but it's a technology. Okay.
So he said specifically you, so what would...
Yeah, specifically
don't
you.
Know, what did you do first?
Yes, tell us about your first experience.
Well, I mean, so...
For those of us who don't know you all.
The first experience was, my mom stroked, along with a bunch of other people, stroked friends and family money.
And we lost
a bunch of money. And it was not quite mortgage in my own personal house, but it was my, kids' inheritance, that I was sort of mortgaging, I guess you could say, along with a lot of other people that sort of believed in what we were doing and relationships. At the end of the day, I keep coming back to it. It's about meeting people and the passion comes out about what you're trying to do, and they have to believe in you. At the end of the day, I don't care what models they come up with and everything else, 98% of investments are done because they believe in you. And it's about the person they're investing in almost 100% of the time. And there's always that 2% where they might invest in sort of something a little bit more interesting. But
so you're not going to make the advice that people should never take money from friends and family?
I think it's a bad thing. But I'm not going to say never, because I've done it and I would probably do it again if I had to, right? Because at the end of the day, it's success and what you're trying to go after in your dream. I think it's a really tough thing. I mean, my family lost a bunch of money, and my second venture-funded venture, my partner's stepfather lost a lot of money, relatively speaking. You can always say that, people can sort of separate their family from their professional kind of investment never will happen, never. So you have to be prepared for the inevitable potential challenge that that brings, and you know that really largely depends on the people. So, I always try to surround myself with people that know a lot more than me and have a lot more connections, so I can use their network sort of through them, and if they have a sort of connection with me and they have a vested interest in what I'm doing, and sort of they will do that.
Do you find venture capital is getting tougher or easier for social media type
of? Very tough. I mean, venture capital is always tough. I mean, as much as, you know, you see people that have raised money and blah, 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 you know, we're talking 1 in 10,000 companies that they see will get funded. I mean, and of those, you know, 1 in 10 will probably get acquired. You know, the 9 will go out of business. I mean, they still have a tough time, too. 98% of businesses go out of business in the first 5 years or something crazy like that. So, and technology, I mean, you know, talking about higher risk. I mean, you know, much higher risk. But not every business is venture fundable.
Right. And
that's the thing you got to be honest with yourself about.
I'll ask one other question, and then I'll pass the baton on. How about your relationships with your venture capitalists? How much do they get in the way of your vision, or put a governor on what it is that you want to accomplish?
So that's a great question. That's probably the, if you get to the privilege of actually having a choice, which is, you know, most people don't, because, you know, oftentimes you have to raise money and you got to take money wherever you can take money. But if you get into the privilege, which I've been in, and we were in this time, we've got several term sheets, so we had sort of the choice to make. It does come down to, it's a partnership. You know, they are buying your company. Even if it's a minority stake, they have enough rights and everything else that, and the person with the purse strings ultimately has all the rights. So you've got to be able to, you know, as much as anything, you got to get to know them and interview them. And so I did due diligence on them. I talked to their portfolio companies. I talked to, you know, a number of people to understand how they would be. And that's why we ended up going with the company we went with versus some bigger ones that we were talking to, because I felt like the partner at the firm knew the vision, shared the vision, was as passionate as I was about what we were trying to accomplish. Whereas the other firms, great people, bigger names, bigger funds, they weren't not passionate, but you know, it sort of comes off. And so I felt like I'll have a little bit more success if I get these guys than the other guys, and I'll get a lot more attention, and it's been very good. But I can tell you that having some bad experience, that's, you know, bad investors can do some serious harm.
Yes.
Thus, why I'm still working. Okay, hold on. I want to come back to you. Let me give him. You got to go or something.
No, that's fine.
Okay.
Just to stay on kind of the topic of your own personal experiences. I know we were kind of talking at the beginning about, you know, our own definitions of success and winning. And you know, reading your bio, I would, you know, consider you a successful person.
Only in the context of Atlanta.
But
even that little small little maybe corner of a lot more successful. I'm not that successful.
Do you personally consider yourself? That was kind of my question. Do you consider yourself a success? And what couple of things have you done in your career with your businesses that you would, you know, say have led to that?
You know, I think success is relative, and I think, like you said, or I think he said it earlier, it's like it's a continual cumulative thing. I mean, certainly I look back and some of the things I've done and how I've gotten here, and I don't know. I don't know that I'd call it success. I've been that successful. We've done a lot of. I mean, I feel like I've done a lot of things, and from where I've come from in life, you know, and my sort of background, I think, you know, I'm fairly successful. But you know, the flip side is I like to be very grounded and look at all the rest of the people in the world that are way more successful than I will, you know, probably ever be, and that's what I aspire to be and try to. Emulate is probably the wrong word, but you know, have some affinity towards those types of people. So I think it's always good to find somebody you admire and sort of, you know, try to sort of follow their lead or whatever. But ultimately, you got to define your own success. You got to be happy with yourself. If you're not happy with yourself, then nothing else is going to make you happy. That's a little bit too psychology wise. All right, go ahead.
I've got two questions. I'm going to save the controversial one.
Okay.
So everybody doesn't leave after this. Atlanta startups, entrepreneurs, at least many of them I know, have sort of Silicon Valley envy.
Yes,
you've been in Atlanta, you've been in Silicon Valley. briefly, can you compare what it's been like to be an entrepreneur in both those places? How is it different to me?
To be purely honest, being an entrepreneur in Atlanta sucks. Being an entrepreneur in the Valley, you know, you're an entrepreneur in the Valley. I mean, it's kind of cool. I mean, now, I can walk down the street and every name I read on the bulletin board, you've read on TechCrunch, you've read, you know, it's, you know, well, no, way more known than we are. I mean, we're right across the street from Mevo and,
right.
you know, all these big name companies. So you're, you know, I think the relative standpoint is you're just another guy with an idea and nobody gives a shit about your idea because their idea is better than your idea, you know, and they're killing it compared to you. And that's sort of the mentality in the Valley.
Right.
Yeah, that has a certain amount of cadence that it creates in your execution. I guess that's the best way I can say it. Not that I didn't, I've always been very hyper anyway. So, but out there, I mean, I can tell you, like, I haven't slept. I haven't gone to bed before 3 a.m. and gotten up before 9 a.m. In the last month, maybe more than a month.
So they are the small fish in the big pond as opposed to the opportunity.
Yeah, and I'll give you another sort of way of kind of thinking about it. We did there was a Silicon Valley code camp, a little Mountain View, which is big, but I mean, it's relatively way small. And it was an event 2 weeks ago. It's kind of like this. It was an unconference. Hey, let's get a bunch of coders together. It's just sort of blog about, you know, let's get a code camp together. 600 people showed up to this code camp. Last month I went to the Mountain View Web Developer Meetup, which is sort of meetup.com, you know, Mountain View people get together. 250 people with Google. I mean, you know, in the Google, biggest conference room at Google. I mean, this is a regular meeting, so the scope and scale of everything is so much, and that's just one of about 50 that happen on a, you know, daily basis. Every day, every night, there's something like SoCon, obviously different context, different content, all the time. I mean, it's overwhelming because you want to go to everything and you spend all your time at these stupid events and not working if I went to, I mean, so there's a lot of different kind of pressure, you know, out there. Your recruiting is extremely difficult because you're recruiting against Google. I mean, you know, I had this great conversation with this engineer about 2 months ago. We were interviewing this guy. Perfect fit. He's like one of the head guys at Google and AdWords infrastructure, and we're building out a SaaS infrastructure. So he's like, good fit. We get all the way to him. We thought it was actually a good interview, you know. We get all the way in, he goes, I don't really know why I'd want to come work for you. I can do all this stuff at Google. And I was just like, well, yeah, I guess you could, you know. Like, well, don't you want to, like, you know. And he's like, well, shit, I can do all that at Google. And you know, it's, you know, Google's a cool company to work at, you know. And so it's just, you know, it's different. You know, here you can probably, if you're really kind of interesting kind of startup, you know, here, you know, you can have a little bit easier time to recruit, kind of get the mantle of interest around Atlanta, the resources of the Atlanta, you know, technorati or whatever. You can sort of, you can easily get sort of in the know pretty quickly. And that's, I think, part of the problem is, you know, people are kind of starving for the prop up the next kind of cool thing.
The other question is based out of a survey that TAG did. They talked to, some of the people in this room are familiar with the blog post I wrote. Basically, they talked to VCs around the country and the United Kingdom. And one of the results was that Atlanta doesn't have enough serial entrepreneurs.
Right.
We can't get these guys to do serial entrepreneurship, and if the ones that do, leave.
Absolutely.
Ben Dyer, I don't know if you know him.
Yes, okay. Ben.
He basically said Atlanta is a two-boat and a Cadillac town.
Exactly.
I've been saying that for years.
Right. Yeah. And the reference being, you know, you can have a $5 million exit, $10 million exit, and then retire comfortably. In the Valley, you have to go back to work.
Well,
there isn't that sort of tribe.
There's more than that. It's a social contract. The Valley is a social contract. It's a requirement to help each other out. Even the biggest billionaires are... You know, I was at a thing last year before I moved to the Valley, Food Camp, which is like Tim O'Reilly's kind of private kind of thing, and I got the privilege of getting to go, and, you know, Sergey flies in on his helicopter, and, you know, we're like hanging out with all the, and these are people that don't, they could not have to be here, you know, they could be anywhere in the world they want to be, and they come to these events, and they help people out, and not just through investing, I mean, that's the small part, I mean, it's through their connections, and, I mean, you look at the Founders Fund, I mean, you know, These are significant people Like Elon Musk, I mean, you know.
So why do you feel Atlanta has the serial entrepreneurship?
Because it's a life, it's, I think it's like, part of it's economic. In Atlanta, you could live in a really nice house. If you made $5 million, okay, yeah, $5 million exit, like you personally put $5 million in a bank. I know a number of people that have just recently done this over the past year. You can live like a king, okay? You can move into a nice house in the suburbs or in downtown, spend your $1 million, get you a house, get some nice cars, get you a boat, and Atlanta will put you on a pedestal. You'll speak at every tag event, and you will be a rock star. Right? There's no motivation to go back into it. There isn't. Or if you're like Mark, who's a good personal friend, Mark Flory from JBoss, who made about $150 million on JBoss, he moved to fucking Spain for 2 years. I mean, if you do that, I mean, there's
no...
He
used to DJ at El Bar also, which was... He used to DJ at El Bar, which is Jeff's old restaurant, so he was contributing to the community.
Exactly. He put his hood on. He didn't want anybody to know it was him, and he walked around, literally, like, he walked around after he made all this money, and he didn't know what to do with his life, and he would walk around to these bars. Serious story. He wanted to become a techno DJ. This is like a $150 million guy, and he walked into these bars, and one day he was so bad none of the DJs would let him play. And one day his story, Mark's telling me, he walks in and pays the guy like $500 to let him DJ for a few minutes. Like, Mark's just like, go away. Let me spin. And literally the guy came running back like 15 minutes later and kicked him out because he was so bad people were getting on the floor or whatever. And he said, look, dude, I'm sorry, but I got it, like, you know, and Mark said. And then he, you know, so anyway, I guess he's got a little bit better. But there's no outside of a few people, John Imlay, there's a few people, again, you know, it becomes a little tiring now because it's been a long time.
It's the same people.
It's the same people. And you can't just hold that mantle. I mean, you know,
but the question is, how do you change that? And if you can't change it, does that permanently stunt Atlanta's startup community?
You change it through a social contract. You change it by entrepreneurs that sit around and say, you know what, if I make it, I'm going to get give back. You can't enforce it. It's just a social contract. It's like anything. It's like, how do you solve food hunger? You know, people just decide they're going to start feeding people and helping and volunteering. That's how you do it. You don't do it because the government says we're going to do it. You do it because, you know, or, you know, something in Atlanta. You do it because people just decide they're going to do it.
But organizing another tech event, like, I'm not going to name names, but organizing another tech event isn't being a serial entrepreneur. Being a serial entrepreneur is starting a new company. That's the issue.
Yes.
Jeff, let me take a quick one. If I want to be an entrepreneur someday, let's say I'm not one now. Please don't write that in the newspaper. What company in Atlanta, besides Servinity, should I go work at to learn how to be an entrepreneur? Which of the five next hot companies in Atlanta? So I can learn the ropes. Ask that question to people who are in the community, and you'd be shocked how little of an answer you ever get.
I couldn't name.
What are the five in Silicon Valley?
Well, come on.
There you go, right? That's the problem, I think.
Well, I have to say that, I mean,
no,
as much as we like having
you
around,
yes, we'll give you
and wish you that you're gone.
You're glad I'm gone.
I'm not glad you're gone at all, but I will say that you rang a wake-up call in the Atlanta venture community that was really undeniable. And I don't think
we'll deny it.
But I mean, it was obvious that, but it rose the question in a lot of people's minds. It's like, well, wait a second, why is, I mean, Jeff's doing good, he's building this thing, it kind of seems to be going well for him, why is he going to Silicon Valley? And, you know, why are we letting him, why are we not providing an environment that keeps people like Jeff here is the secondary unsaid question. And that, I think, has really gone a lot of way down the road to spur Startup Gauntlet, you know, Startup Lounge, and a lot of these other smaller and more energized concerns that to start building that ecosystem.
Yeah, I think
it's not.
I've always said this. I continue to say it. I think the entrepreneurs are the ones that are going to fix this issue. People in this room are going to fix it. It ain't going to be the bankers and the, you know, lawyers. I mean, they're going to do, if anything, they're going to take all the money away while you try to do it.
I'll tell you who can help accelerate change probably more than anybody is the school system. We got some great schools around the area, especially you talk Georgia Tech right over there. You talk Georgia, we just started an entrepreneurship program up in Athens. I mean, these things, like, we got so many great resources, especially like the computer science program at Georgia Tech. where they're not even inclined to think that they're going to start their own companies.
Yeah, well, that's the problem. So another contrast, and I'll come back to that because I got some experience there. In Stanford, the biggest problem Stanford has is keeping kids in school because they can't. They are pent up to either go join a cool startup or to start a startup, and that's one of their biggest problems. They have like a lot of dropout at the third, fourth year level because of that.
There's
two big problems. One is the school systems are we're training people at the sort of state level, state college level, to leave. We're training them to leave the state and take the state dollars that we've invested in them and move it somewhere else. And that's a big problem. We did a study back in the Aggie days for Georgia Tech around that. It was like you need to start thinking about programming. I mean, think about it. Georgia Tech has a great semiconductor program for years. How many semiconductor companies do we have in Atlanta? Like, how about -4? So what that meant was, and not that those aren't great programs. I mean, the university has to think about bigger than just Atlanta, but that just automatically means that every single person that graduates will not work here. You look at MIT and Harvard and some of these other areas, and they don't always suffer from some of the same things. Stanford obviously doesn't suffer from that. And so I think the universities, it's hard though, because their endowments are a lot different than just about the local community. And so it's a tough balance they have. But I do think that you can teach entrepreneurship in the colleges and equip people with skills and just even tell people that they can actually own their own business or start their own ideas and make money from them. Most people don't think that.
And I think at that age, it's most important. And I think that's where change is going to come from, because think about all the big companies that, especially the digital-based companies that have come out over the last 5-10 years, they were all started by guys under the age of 30.
That's right.
And that means if you ingrain it at the high school level, at the college level, we're going to stick around and we're going to actually start stuff.
And frankly, I'll go into some questions. I think that's probably the single biggest risk to venture capital, in traditional and institutional venture capital, is that as well. Because I think the democratization of tools and the ability to kind of create value, especially for high-tech producers, content or video or software or whatever those are, you can actually, with the global internet distribution platform, you can actually create a very meaningful personal business, personal lifestyle, revenue, and not have to join a big company or not have to raise venture capital. We're talking to more and more people out in the valley who, they're like, fuck venture capital. We're doing this on our own. We've got software as a service. We can do all the technology ourselves, and we can get $40,000-$50,000 a month in revenue, and we don't need to raise money.
I just wanted to comment about the people leaving. I work in the creative industry, the design industry, and we see the same thing too. People go to New York, they go to LA, they go to San Francisco. But what I see, because I work with most of senior level folks, is they come back when they have babies. They come back. After they've sort of made their names.
So they get their Cadillac and their two boats.
And they come back. But I think we miss an opportunity as a marketplace to leverage that they've gone to the bigger markets and they've learned. And they bring this incredible knowledge back.
Yeah, I agree with that.
The challenge is that they want lifestyle when they come back. And so they're not as driven, they're not as hungry. They've achieved a relevant amount of success. And they're in the, most of my seat are in the, I don't know what's next. I've been successful. I want to be home, but I don't know how to motivate myself for the next thing. So the comment you made about your friend that went to Spain, it's like that's what a lot of people are coming here to do. They're coming here to take a break from the rat race.
Yeah.
And how we use that as a market is still a big question mark for everybody. But that's when you just look at the reality of where we are, that's
yeah,
generally
very, very true. Come back. Well, Dave,
you can... Yeah, just a quick question. It kind of relates to a little bit of what Chris said a minute ago. Well, you were asking who would you say the best companies to go to?
The size of their flex is, I think, what he said.
Yeah, you don't want to learn from me.
Well,
Chris might want to learn from me because he said you wanted to learn more failures. But speaking about what you were saying in the Valley, in terms of a lot of the startup entrepreneurs, the guys that actually started the companies, how visible are those guys that have already been successful in the community opposed to here?
Very visible.
Well, I mean, I've never met Jeff Arnold or Chris Klaus or...
You never will.
Yeah, I mean, you name it. Yeah, I've seen Mark. I mean, everybody that's been successful here, like you said, disappears. They don't come back. This would, I don't know, is this considered beneath them or something, but... you were saying at food camp, you know, Sergey flies in.
Yeah, no, I mean, so they're talking to the guy.
He's there.
We have an advisor, a guy named Larry Augustin, is one of the world's best known open source sort of entrepreneurs. He comes to our office every week. I mean, we spend real quality time. He doesn't have to. He's got plenty of money. I mean, he can sort of go get his boat, his couple Cadillacs, and, you know, go retire. And he has got a huge house in the valley. I mean, he could, you know, he lives great, you know.
Sure.
But no, he works hard. I mean, the guy has a schedule that's crazier than mine. I mean, and he does it not because of money. I mean, he makes a lot of money from it. Obviously, he gets equity, and, you know, he loves that kind of thing. He does it because he loves technology. He loves helping entrepreneurs out. And it's a fairly somewhat semi-selfish endeavor for him, because for him, he's got so much experience, and he sees a lot of different companies, and he can help. I'm part of another group called the Open Source CEO thing. And it's all these sort of open source CEOs. And we get together every quarter, and it's all about, I mean, it's, you know, I'm not too indifferent than what might happen here in Atlanta, but, you know, with just slightly larger, you know, well-known companies, but it's all about how can we help each other out. It's like, and we talk about how do we help each other out. You know, what kind of deals you got going on that I can help out, and it's literally like a startup dinner type thing, but, you know, where people helping out, these are fairly successful people. I mean,
what do you think that's something, though, that the community here could do to change? I mean, like, I've seen, like, Mitch Free at one or two tag events.
Yeah, like Mitch is great. I mean,
and he's a great guy, but he's, you know, he's always in Montreal or China or wherever his next house is.
Yeah.
And that's cool. I mean, he's earned it. But do you think it's that these guys are a little different? Maybe they're more driven by the money than they are by the passion for what they're doing.
I don't know. Like, I wouldn't say Mitch is. I mean, I know Mitch.
Well, not using Mitch as an example.
Yeah, but I mean, I think it's part of it is a challenge of, you know, the velocity of the companies here and the sheer number of companies relatively. I mean, you know, I think the other problem is you've got a lot of these people coming back. They don't know what to do. Like, there's not, I mean, I couldn't name 10 companies here that I could sort of recommend anybody to go work at right now.
Exactly.
There's a couple of cool companies.
But do you think there's a falling down, too, though, on say, the startup community's part? Are we not asking these people to show up?
Yeah, I mean, another thing I've been harping, and Lance hates it, but I've been harping about HDC. I mean, how many companies are there? Do you know of any? I mean, are you guys still in there? Are you in there?
No, we interviewed. We didn't go in.
Okay. I mean, do you know of any really companies? I mean, there's companies that have been there forever that need, like, a Sonicia that sort of need to be kicked out.
It's also, like graduating 2 years.
Yeah, exactly.
It's like 5 years.
But it's like, you know, I mean, that's a PR problem. I mean, they ought to be, you know, part of their values to hold those guys up, help them, and everybody in this room should know about it. And that's how it used to be. It used to be, in the .com days, to get into the ATDC was a big deal.
Exactly.
You know, Mindspring was there, Relevant Knowledge was there. I mean, it was well-known companies that came out of there. And it was, you know, you got a lot of, it pretty much meant you got funded if you could get in.
Well, don't you think that it's become more of a vehicle for them to build up their padding and their cloud,
make
more safe funds? It's less about really helping the company. I'm not blasting ATDC, but.
Is no one in the entrepreneur room from an ATDC company right now?
See, that's shocking. If we'd have had event 10 years, and we had events like this during the .com days, we would run a bunch of kind of things like this and have parties. I mean, it was like, who's in the ATDC? It was the big thing, you know?
Yeah.
But
and I'm wondering if, though, like I said, if we just need to just start asking some of these guys to show up. Because, I mean, I'd be surprised. I wonder if any of these guys have been asked
exactly
to come to this.
No, I think it's
does Mitch even know this is going on? I mean, does...
Well, it's kind of funny, because Sanjay didn't show up, David Cummings didn't show up, Wade didn't show up. These people that actually, over the last few years, have showed up.
Exactly.
So, they have their own personal issues, reasons why, but...
But in general, you should expect at least a tiny percentage of some of the startup guys that have done before to be here.
I think what's happening more so these days, I mean, sure, there's the kind of the, I don't know, the plot way of saying it, but, there's the guys who kind of run kind of the Atlanta startup mafia, so to speak. And, you know, there's that. But what's happening more and more, and that's cool, and they do some good stuff. I'm not talking shit about it. But what's happening more and more, in my experience, is different startups are getting together, and, like, you and I had lunch, and we're starting to do stuff independently, you know, and getting together and helping each other out. Like, we've thrown down the gauntlet with Speed Scrub. You know, we're going to kick their asses in Rock Band. And it's that kind of thing. It's getting beyond... And everyone's so obsessed with what can you do for me and let's do all this in such a formal way. You have to build relationships. That's what Jeff's saying. And then you'll have each other's back just because you like each other, you know? And because pretty much everyone's fairly likable, I think, for the most part. It's just a different way of looking at it, which is just, I think, different from a lot of people who want to over-organize everything, which has kind of been the way.
Yeah. All right, we got one last thing, and you had one last... Okay, you don't have a contract. Okay, go ahead.
Go back to what I did earlier, where we have to do it.
Yeah.
Who's going to do it?
Yes. And you're waiting for the startup mafia to do it. I can guarantee you, while they're on their boat in the Boca, they're not going to be quite thinking about this.
It starts with the commitment to each other and to the community and saying, we will create that culture.
I've often said, I've said this the last 3 years, everybody in these conference should sort of spin off and go do their own sort of conference thing. Not necessarily a SoCon. They might do a co-working thing or a Jelly or do another, SoCon on the east side of Atlanta or something like that.
I might throw out a suggestion. It sounds to me like we need to set up a social network, maybe like the Bootstrap Coalition or something, where all of these people that are searching for a way to do their startups can get together and bootstrap each other.
Go for it.
Don't wait for the startups and the angel investors and the other well-established people to do it for you. Do it yourself.
Jen Bonet, anybody knows her? She's ex eTour CTO, good friend. She just started a thing last week, I think, on Maine. It was women's
startup chicks.
That's it, startup chicks.
Startup chicks.
Absolutely. There should be no reason we shouldn't be doing this. All right, thanks for coming, guys. Appreciate it. Nice meeting all you guys.
The song you heard in this podcast was Garden by Cargo Cult, available only on Magnatune.com. Thanks for listening to Unconcast on the Georgia Podcast Network. If you have recorded or are planning to record a discussion that you think would make a good episode of Unconcast, email us at info@gapodcastnetwork.com to learn how you can submit it.